Hello, everybody. My name is Bob Ollander. I'm here just to sort of get us kicked off for this session. And thank you for attending the 2020 SunStone Digital Symposium, session 341, titled Pushed to the Edge, a Historical Discourse Analysis of the Intersections of Feminism, Transgender Healthcare, and Mormonism. The audio from this session will be available for purchase at sunstone.org after the symposium. The video recording of this session will be available in the Whova app for the remainder of 2020. Now, your schedule says that this session is a 60-minute session, but the presentation will actually last 60 minutes, and we've been given permission to go longer to accommodate a Q&A. So, in the Whova app, you can submit questions for Stacy to answer. And then after her presentation is done, about 60 minutes, then she'll answer questions. So submit those there. And just stay with us as long as you can. If you aren't able to join because you have to run to another session, the session is being recorded, and so you can come back and watch the Q&A later. At SunStone, we are making it a goal to build a community that allows many ways for people to express their faith. Our tagline is, there is more than one way to Mormon. We invite you to help us build a community where all paths are given space to be better understood. Please support us in our mission by making a donation and subscribing at sunstone.org. Now I would like to hand it off to Amy Evans Hickman, who will introduce the session and our speaker.
Thank you. I am so delighted to be able to introduce my dear friend, Stacy. Stacy Jackson Roberts is a transgender woman who was raised in a devout LDS farming and cattle ranching family in Beaver, Utah. During her gender transition, she was confirmed in the Episcopal Church at the Washington National Cathedral and now identifies as Episcopal, which I love. Professionally, Stacy is currently a psychotherapist in private practice in Washington, D.C. suburb of Silver Spring, Maryland. She specializes in gender and sexuality and has presented and consulted on these topics nationally and internationally. Previously, she was the lead therapist for transgender LGBTQ behavior health at a federally qualified healthcare center in Baltimore, Maryland, where she led the creation of the LGBT Health Resource Center and Gender Joy Journeys of Youth program, offering mental health, puberty suppression, and gender-affirming hormone therapy to transgender youth. Prior to changing careers, Stacy worked for nearly a decade in health and law policy, including on the committee and staff of Senator Edward M. Kennedy and managing the Access to Essential Medicine Program and programs on information justice and intellectual property at American University Washington College of Law. In 2013, she was awarded an MSW in clinical social work from the Smith College School for Social Work, where her training focused on psychodynamic theory and practice with an anti-racism pedagogy. Prior to attending Smith, she earned a Certificate of Advanced Graduate Study in Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies from American University, where her concentration was on gender and queer theory. As formidable as Stacy's professional and educational credentials are, it is her sustained commitment to educate and advocate for not only trans lives, but true intersectional justice for all oppressed communities that has helped teach me what real sisterhood looks like. Some of you may have first met our presenter in the Exponent Facebook group, where she has been boldly challenging unexamined discourse among our 5,000 member community that intentionally or unintentionally excludes those who most need our care. I've also had the privilege of seeing Stacy advocate for justice in our shared city of Baltimore, where she engages community leaders and citizens with her brilliance and unflinching mind and morally just perspective. In an unjust society where Stacy has had to fight for everything in order to live authentically, from medical care to discrimination-free employment to ending harassment in all forms, I have never seen Stacy advocate for herself without also making sure those rights and opportunities are extended to others. There are employment policies and healthcare coverages that have expanded nationwide because of Stacy. Her brilliant, vulnerable, and unflinching honesty has also played a monumental role in awakening individuals and institutions like Exponent 2 and Sunstone and others to what real intersectional feminism should look like and how much our organizations must continually transform to become more just and safe for the most vulnerable among us. On a personal note, Stacy's efforts to help our shared communities understand more about the trans experience has fundamentally changed my perspective and unexamined assumptions in every way. When I first met her in person, I knew I was meeting someone with a fierce mind and clever wit, but I had no idea I was meeting someone who was also so warm and generous and became an instant lifelong friend. I'm so excited to be able to introduce Stacy to you as a friend and for all of us to learn from her today. It is my great pleasure to welcome Stacy Jackson Roberts.
I'm really toasting. Thank you for that amazing introduction. Thank you for being willing to moderate this panel or this presentation. So why don't we go ahead and get started? Let me just get my screen shared here. One moment. Okay, so this presentation is a little bit of a take on my thesis with integrating a bit of Mormon history and whatnot into the research that I did as far as my graduate training. We already went over kind of my credentials, or at least Amy did. But I want everybody, as we're going through this presentation, to kind of consider this quote from Audre Lorde. Black and third world people are expected to educate white people as to our humanity. Women are expected to educate men. Lesbian and gay men are expected to educate the heterosexual world. The oppressors maintain their position and evade their responsibility for their own actions. There is a constant draining of energy which might be better used to redefine ourselves and devise realistic scenarios for altering the present and constructing the future. So I think it's really important to keep that in mind as we move through this, and I'm going to be laying out kind of a foundation of theoretical orientation before we move into some of the more of the history to kind of frame how we're examining the literature and the history. So keep in mind, this may seem a bit messy because we are kind of looking at three different histories that are simultaneously separate and distinct, and yet often overlapping and interacting with each other. So we have the field of medicine as it pertains to trans healthcare. We have Mormonism as it pertains to doctrine. We have feminism and gender theory. So I want to go through first some stats about the transgender community, so you can understand how this actually affects everyday life for transgender individuals and their marginalization. So I normally ask what 41% might represent, but given our situation right now, can't do that. So I'm just going to go right ahead and reveal that 41% of transgender individuals have attempted suicide at least once in their lifetime. And this is juxtaposed the general population, which is above 1.5%. Now, this figure actually whitewashes that number. So if we're actually taking an intersectional frame, we start to pull this apart and we start to see that actually racial minorities that are dealing with multiple bias of oppression have significantly higher rates of suicidality because of their marginalization. So you have American Indians at 36%, multiracial individuals at transgender individuals at 34%, African American or Black individuals at 45%. Latino or Latinx individuals at 44% and Asians at 39%. If we look at HIV, the HIV contraction rate for transgender individuals is 4 times the national average. But again, if we pull that apart and look at who's really dealing with the multiple binds of marginalization, Black transgender individuals are at 24.9%. Latinx at 10.92%, American Indians at 7%, Asians at 3.79%, and white individuals 0.75%. So we start to see how race starts to actually play a part in the marginalization here of transgender individuals. And if you look down at the bottom, trans sex workers, it's a 15.32% HIV contraction rate. Now, if we look at poverty within the transgender community, if you're transgender, it's four times, you're four times as likely to live in extreme poverty, which is living at a salary of, or income of $10,000 a year or less. Two times as likely to be unemployed. 50% have been fired, not been hired, demoted, or been denied promotion due to their gender identity or expression. And 19% have been evicted or denied housing. If we look at the healthcare statistics, 19% of transgender individuals have been denied critical medical care. 28% have experienced harassment in a medical setting. 2% have been assaulted by a medical provider. Often this is in the form of genital checks to check the gender of the individual. 50% had to educate the provider of their healthcare needs. I've actually had to do that when I first got on hormones. I had to actually do my own research and go in and educate my doctor about how I needed access to care and how they should be prescribing care for me. Being out as a transgender individual and medical to their medical provider actually increases the likelihood of experiencing harassment or being refused care. 50% have postponed care because of safety concerns, and 88% delayed seeking care because of inability to pay. Now, as we're moving through this, I want to make sure that people are understanding that this care is considered medically necessary care. There is actually a legal definition and a definition by the leading professional associations. Basically, the treatment for transgender individuals alleviates the symptomology and increases functionality. So when you're looking at anything that is within the realm of medicine, that's basically the definition of medically necessary care. So transition-related care is considered medically necessary. The AMA has affirmed this. The World Professional Association of Transgender Health has affirmed this. The National Association of Social Work, the American Psychiatric Association, American Psychological Association, and many other professional associations have affirmed that this is medically necessary care. So historical discourse analysis. It is a method of reading, writing, and interpreting using the lens of critique. Historical discourse analysis works against the objectivist fallacy of traditional positivist historical methods in decentering the authority of the historian as a neutral recorder of fact and the claim of historical writings as objective reconstructions of past events. So what this is saying is rather than being concerned with documenting historical truths, historical discourse analysis is focus on analyzing the discursive production of history and more particularly the dynamics and construction of power. So as we move through this and we're looking at the different things, you'll notice that I'm looking at who is doing the writing or making the decisions and what powers and influences are coming to bear. So again, we need a theoretical foundation. Radical feminism is a branch of feminism that came out of the second wave during the 60s and 70s. Many of the theorists of the time were writing on trans issues, but one particular that stands out is Janice Raymond, who wrote a book called The Transsexual Empire, The Making of the She-Man. She asserts that transgender women, and notice she's focused on transgender women, not transgender men or non-binary individuals, appropriate the female body, and that is a taking, and thus trans women rape all women by appropriating female bodies and penetrating female space. And she locates trans women as the enemy rather than the patriarchal institutions that construct true transsexual women within the hegemonic ideals of womanhood. We'll get into more of this as we move on to the presentation to explain that, and I think it'll make a lot more sense. Post-structural feminists, if we look at Judith Butler, stands out with her book, Gender Trouble. She takes a Beauvoirian and Foucauldian post-structuralist view of gender and sex saying that they are socially constructed and are rooted in performativity. Now, I want to stop here just to make sure when people hear social construction, some people think that that means that it's not real. And that's quite not true. A car is a social construct. A house is a social construct. It means that we give it meaning through social relations. And so, and for her, gender is and sex are performative. We get up and begin the work anew each day of performing these repetitive motions that become naturalized and unconscious in the way that we perform gender. She challenges historical assumptions of universality of womanhood and the fallacy of sisterhood. She asserts that time, place, race, sexuality, and class complicate the term woman. She also challenges the historical feminist assumption that sex is innate. So the second wave, the radical feminists said, yep, gender, social constructed, agree there, but they say that sex is innate. And she's saying, nope, gender is actually also social, or sex is also socially constructed. For Butler, gender functions as a signifier of sex bodies as dependent on gender to signify and give meaning to sex. Ergo, sex is dependent on gender, and thus sex is a social construct. Gender is not an arrived state. We get up each morning and begin the work anew. And performance of gender is a constant failure. We do not ever officially arrive at a point where we are now done and we are women and men, where the performance is complete and the reproduction or production of gender has been accomplished. Therefore doesn't need to be continued to be performed. In an attempt to define man or woman, male or female, one begins to understand the notions of gender rely on fallacies of universality and innate attributes of sex. Butler draws on the work of Simone de Beauvoir to examine the dynamics of power vis-a-vis the construction of sex and gender. Attempts to answer the question of what constitutes man, male, or female woman illustrate the dynamics of power through the use of phallocentric discourse of compulsory heterosexuality and reproduction. Intersectional feminism, so we're progressing through and evolving to now where we're at with intersectional feminism. This concept was coined by Kimberly Crenshaw, who is a professor of law at UCLA. And what came up for her is there was a court case where an African-American woman had been denied a job. And when she brought the case, basically it was an entire company and they were hiring African-American men to work in the shop, working on the tires and whatnot. And they were hiring white women to work in clerical roles and whatnot, but they weren't hiring black women. And when she brought the court case, it was dismissed because the judge said that basically she was having two bites of the apple. And she needed a framework to help others understand that actually there's this intersection. It's like an intersection of the road. You've got these different lines of oppression that are simultaneously interacting. And therefore, she's experiencing discrimination because she is a black woman, and therefore not having access to these employment opportunities. And because of that, there's no universal experience. One black woman doesn't experience that at the same intersections because of her time, location, her sexuality, generational influences, and things like that. If we start to pull this apart and look at this within intersectionality and anti-oppression, we start to pull apart these systems of power. So patriarchy and sexism is a system where men have power over women. Racism is a system where white people have power in relation to black and indigenous people of color. Heteronormativity or homophobia is a system where straight people have power in relation to lesbian, gay, bisexual, and queer people. cisnormativity, transphobia is a system where cisgender individuals have power in relation to transgender, non-binary, or gender non-conforming individuals. And ableism is a system of power where able-bodied individuals and able-minded individuals are have power in relation to those with disabilities. So if we're to take an anti-oppression approach, we have to pay attention to who has power and privilege in these dynamics. And when I say that, I don't mean that once you, if you're a white man, it doesn't mean your life hasn't been hard. It means that maybe race was not a barrier for you, or your sexual orientation was not a barrier for you. It's important to understand that dynamic as these power dynamics play out in these discourses. So if we start to get into actually the history here. So in 1952, Christine Jorgensen returns from Denmark. She was an American GI who transitioned in Denmark, and it was blown all over the US media. Sensationalized ex-GI becomes Bond Beauty or Bombshell were all the headlines. And so this is when this really starts to enter the American consciousness that there are trans people. We've existed for millennia, if not, we've been around for at least centuries, if not millennia. But this was pretty sensational. It was in the media, and that's when it starts to enter the American consciousness. So as it starts to enter the American consciousness, people start to contact this doctor in New York City named Harry Benjamin, who's considered the father of transsexuality. These are individuals that are experiencing gender dysphoria, but had never had, because of a cisnormative society, a language to put with it. So they reach out to him for support and guidance and whatnot. He ultimately writes a book called The Transsexual Phenomenon in 1966. Now keep in mind, this is 3 years after Betty Friedan's The Feminist Mystique and after what many within Mormon circles are familiar with, Fascinating Womanhood. This is the time frame when the LDS Church is really trying to reconstruct its image, public image, and really reinforce a lot of hegemonic gender norms to try to, particularly with part of the post-war efforts with sending women back into the home and kitchen and whatnot. So there's a lot of things going on with gender around this time. It's also 6 years before homosexuality is removed from the DSM. DSM is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Health Conditions. This book was considered a central authority for diagnosis and treatment of transgender individuals. Now, you'll notice throughout my slide, I use the term transsexual. That's technically an archaic term. I'm using it because it was the term used at the time, and it's very much focused on those that are seeking medical intervention to change. It is also the term that I actually do identify with because I have sought out medical intervention to change my sex traits to align with my gender identity. Ultimately, what is now WPATH was originally the Harry Benjamin International Gender Dysphoria Association, named in honor of this doctor. The transsexual phenomenon was a pioneering attempt to document and formulate and professionalize diagnostic and treatment protocols for transsexuals. It was written for the medical profession and the laity. So it was a little paperback book that you could buy, and so trans individuals out in the community could buy it, they could read it and understand it, and also take it to a medical professional and hopefully get help. It influenced compulsory scripted narratives that individuals were required to maintain in order for health professionals to sanction the patient as a true transsexual, granting or denying access to hormones and surgeries. It was also a compassionate attempt to provide a diagnostic foundation and justify treatment within a patriarchal medical establishment. When you think about this, 1960s, most of the doctors, if not all of the doctors, are white heterosexual men. Yet was also an instrument of power that compelled conformity to hegemonic ideals of gender that marginalized individuals. Failing to adhere to such standards of true transsexuality was a basis for denial of transition-related treatment. In chapter one, Harry Benjamin lays out an elaborate exploration of various aspects of sex. and the potential for sex variance outside the traditional sex binary. To quote him, he says that the better educated person knows the existence of intersex and true and pseudo hermaphrodites in whom the physical sex is in doubt. Yet in subsequent chapters, he reveals that concepts of sex that appear to be deeply rooted in this essentialist notion of sex, gender, and sexuality, which in turn informs the scripts used to construct and pathologize transsexuals. As Benjamin put it, these persons, in a strictly scientific sense, fool themselves. No actual change of sex is ever possible. If a chromosomal study should be made, however, the true chromosomal sex would be discovered. So let's trouble this a little bit. Consider an individual with an XY chromosomal makeup but has androgen insensitivity syndrome. This means that their androgen receptors, the receptors to the testosterone, can't detect testosterone. So the individual develops as a female and is raised and socialized as a woman. Is she not a woman? Is she not female? Should she be marginalized as less than true woman because, as Benjamin asserts, her true chromosomal sex is male? What are the underlying drives that are influencing such rigid adherence to essentialist notions of sex and gender? If we've got all the science that's showing actual diversity, there are over 24 different types of intersex conditions. And so there's a lot of diversity as far as it's not just this dimorphic male-female. It's a spectrum of wide variety between. So if we start to get into some of the other publications of the time, this book, Transsexualism and Sex Reassignment, this was an anthology that was edited by Richard Green and John Money from Johns Hopkins. Richard Green was at UCLA. It had 35 contributors, only 3 of whom were women. Of those 3, 1 was a graduate student, 1 was a surgical RN, and 1 was a psychologist. The psychologist's article within the anthology was concerned with transsexual intelligence. Basically, all these trans individuals were blowing the bell curve as far as intelligence. I have some theories about that. I won't go into them now, but as of right now, there's a high correlation between autism spectrum disorder and gender dysphoria. So I think there might have been some early signs of that at that time. But notice who's writing this. This is largely white heterosexual men that are writing these anthologies and writing these narratives and doing this research on trans people. This other book, Sexual Identity and Conflict in Children and Adults, from 1968, was written by Richard Green. It had 18 chapters, only 4 of which addressed female to male individuals or masculine traits in girls. The other 14 chapters were dedicated to male to female individuals or feminine boys. So you start to see that they're very focused on boys or men, or who they perceive to be as boys and men, becoming women or girls. Critical to understanding what dynamics of power are brought to bear on developing the diagnostic criteria and treatment protocols. When the clinician establishing the means and modes of treatment are predominantly male, is cause for skepticism as to how the diagnostic and treatment protocols might be unduly influenced by hegemonic concepts of sex, gender, and sexuality. Given the patriarchal nature of the medical establishment with few women clinicians at the time, the defining symptoms and traits of the true transsexual was constructed vis-a-vis the gaze, desires, and sexual utility to the heterosexual male. Symptomology, pathology, and a construction of figment of imagination. So one of the criteria was compulsory heterosexuality. A true transsexual woman was required to be sexually attracted to men. It was unfathomable for these clinicians that a transsexual woman's sexual orientation would differ from these male clinicians' construction of normative female sexuality, i.e. passive and heterosexual. Gender and sexuality were conflated as one and the same. To quote directly from Benjamin, the transsexual feels himself to be a woman and is attracted to, sorry, my screen's cutting off here. The transsexual shows as, sorry, it's hard to read. Just 1 second. The transsexual shows himself to be a woman and attracted to men. The transsexual shows a much greater degree of sex and gender role disorientation and emotional disturbance. He feels only for the day when his female soul is no longer outraged by his body, when he can function as a female, socially, legal, and sexually. In the meantime, he is often asexual or masturbates on occasion, imagining himself to be a woman. Notice the passive sexuality there, because at the time, he didn't think women had their own sexuality. Nullification, sexual gratification, and objectification. While compulsory heterosexuality in transsexual women illuminates social nullification of female sexuality, the nature and early surgical techniques provide additional insight into the power latent narratives and practices that have informed treatment for transsexual women. Consequences that led to the physical nullification and objectification of the body of transsexual women. Surgeons during the 1960s through the 80s were focused on surgical techniques that were constructed a modestly sensate vaginal cavity for transsexual women, but not with creating a sensate clitoris. The surgical construction of the male vagina centered on the sexual gratification of male partners and the sexual objectification of the transsexual woman. To quote Benjamin, the peanut, by the way, this is no longer the technique. This was the technique of the time. It evolved quite substantially. The penile skin is utilized to create a labia minora. All these tissues contain sensory nerve endings, which may later help to convey sexual satisfaction, possibly climaxing in orgasm. The creation of the artificial vagina is, for many transsexual males, the crucial part of the operation. Notice all the also non-affirming language through all this, always more referring to trans women as males or trans men. And so notice the lack of affirming language throughout this. The transsexual seeking out clinical literature to better understand themselves and possible medical interventions, accessible literature like Benjamin's transsexual phenomenon informed the lexicon and constructed scripts for accessing care. A high degree of adherence to feminine stereotypes on the part of male transsexuals that may be part of the result of a conscious, superficial imitation of female behavior. So on the one hand, we have these really strict ideals of what you have to adhere to in order to access care. And then over here, they are puzzled by how strict trans people are being to these superficial imitations of female behavior. So these are scripts that transsexuals are compelled to maintain with high rigidity to appease and convince gatekeepers that they warrant surgery and related transitional procedures. In addition to compulsory heterosexuality, sexual passivity, and gender, and ambitions, born trapped in the wrong body and God made a mistake are just a couple of the cliche scripts that have been perpetuated by the diagnostic protocols. For me, I don't like the phrase God made a mistake. This was the journey I was born into. So I think there are different ways people frame their experience as trans. Transsexual women's gender expression are, sorry, I got a cracked screen, it's hard to read this. expressions are seen through trivializing terminology, including masquerading, imitation, superficial, abnormal, artificial, and deviant. The use of these terms by clinicians is indicative of the positivist views of sex and gender, is dismissive of the experiences of transsexual women as fallacies. These publications betray a constant process of linguistic demarcation, distinguishing the normal, real, and true from those experiences that are deemed abnormal, artificial, and deviant. Closure of Johns Hopkins Gender Identity Clinic and the repercussions. John Money had been the head of Johns Hopkins Clinic, and Johns Hopkins was kind of the central place where all this was happening. There were three other primary clinics around the country, University of Minnesota, UCLA, and Northwestern, that were doing this as well, but all kind of feeding in and off of Johns Hopkins. After the situation with Hopkins, Money left to go to medical school in Virginia to work on fertility issues, in vitro fertilization, and John Meyer takes over as the head of the Department of Psychiatry. He's the primary person responsible for evaluating suitability for treatment, including surgery. He becomes concerned that patients seeking surgery would often deviate into topics such as grief and loss. Now, it's important to note that the criteria at the time actually required going what we call stealth. You were to sever ties with your past and transition and become this trans woman, or in the case of trans man, but they were primarily concerned with trans women at the time. And cut off ties with your past. And he's puzzled as to why there's this grief and loss issue. So it prompts him to do what he calls an objective quantitative follow-up study to the long-term benefits of surgery. Meyer's objectivist approach failed to be conscious of the ways in which it is impossible to be a neutral historian, impaired his consciousness of the ways that his normative ideas informed the study. Based on the normative expectations of transsexual women to find suitably gendered employment, marry a normal, meaning heterosexual man, obtain a gendered education, and become socially affirmed as their gender identity. As such, surgical success was measured by transsexual women's ability to conform to heteronormative middle-class expectations of being a woman, to obtain a gendered college education or vocational school like a nurse, teacher, secretary, get married to a heterosexual man, become his doting housewife who derives her sexual gratification from meeting her husband's sexual desires. After all, the surgical procedures at the time remove most sexual sensitivity with the exception of phallic penetration. And in 1979, he released the study, and he determines we now have objective evidence that it is there's no real difference in the transsexual adjustment in terms of job, educational attainment, marital adjustment, and social stability. In other words, the surgery is not useful because these trans women weren't able to achieve the standard. Money refutes in the literature the findings, asserting that the value of surgery should be measured via the qualitative subjectivities of the patient, not the quantifiable data points measured against normative expectations of success. Enter Paul McHugh. Paul McHugh is appointed to the faculty at Johns Hopkins in 1974. And he has published that he actually sought out that position in order to close the clinic. He becomes the head of the department in 1979, just as the Myers-Rinner studies comes out. He used the Myers-Rinner study to actually close the clinic. Given Johns Hopkins' stature in the medical community as the top medical school and hospital in the U.S., other medical schools, school-based clinics closed their doors. Paul McHugh is also often used in court cases. Still to this day, he's now a emeritus faculty from Johns Hopkins against trans care. So denial, so how this affects the denial of coverage. Coverage by Medicaid and insurance, this trans care was covered by Medicaid and insurance through the 60s and 70s, specifically Title 19 states that Medicaid agencies may not arbitrarily deny or reduce the amount, duration, or scope of required of a required service under Section 440.230, or otherwise eligible recipients solely because of the diagnosis, type of illness, or condition. However, in the 70s, there's this court case out of Georgia, the Rush case. Initially, the district court ruled that transsexualism is a condition, as a condition, cannot be excluded from coverage under state-operated, federally funded Medicare programs. However, the appeals court reverses this ruling and sent it back to the lower court to determine whether the state had a policy and procedure in place for prohibiting experimental procedures, and whether the state's determination of gender confirmation surgery or sexually assigned surgery as experimental was reasonable. The final decision by the district court relied on language from the DSM-3. Of note, we're on DSM-5 right now. Since surgical sex reassignment is a recent development, the long-term course of this disorder with this treatment is unknown. Thus, the state could bar coverage based on the experimental nature of the surgery. And our 1981, keep in mind who's now coming into the White House, 1981, Ronald Reagan, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, codify this exclusion by issuing a new rule, or regulatory rule, within the national coverage determination on Medicare and Medicaid. And as part of this process, they had Janice Raymond, remember her from the book I mentioned at the beginning, who has positioned herself as a medical ethicist, and commissioned her to write a medical ethics paper as part of the rulemaking process, saying that it wasn't medically ethical to do surgery, transition related surgery. So we know how unbiased that was, right? Because of the lack of well-controlled long-term studies and effectiveness of the surgical procedure and the attendant therapies for transsexualism, the treatment is considered experimental. Transsexual surgery is not covered. So this stays on the book from 1981 until 2014 under the Obama administration, just so you know. And it's been part of those rules that you may have heard about recently in the news that the Trump administration has been trying to roll back. There's a saying, once as goes Medicaid, there goes insurance. So private insurance company begin to include exclusion clauses based on experimental or cosmetic nature of gender confirmation surgery. With the closure of Johns Hopkins and affiliated university clinics and increasing opposition and scrutiny to the treatment of transgender individuals, the Harry Benjamin Association, now WPATH, was formed in 1979 as a multidisciplinary professional association to conduct research, promote evidence-based standards of treatment, and engage in public policy advocacy. And they, in 1979, they published their first version of the standards of care, which regulated the diagnostic and treatment protocols. We're now currently on version 7, which was published in 2011, and version 8 is about to be released any time now. So that's all going on, and at the same time, we've got this stuff going on with the church. So I'm going to transition into kind of going into the church history. So as many of you may have heard, Taylor Petrie has a new book out, Tabernacles of Clay. So this next section is going to be drawing a lot from his book. Excuse me. So during this time frame, there appeared to be a significant divergence of thought and debate among the Clement the 12th and the general authorities around gender and the pre-existence during the post-war decades up through the early 80s. So keep in mind, in the 1960s, correlation, there's a lot of stuff going around, not just transgender stuff, but gender, with correlation, they subsume the Relief Society, they do a Relief Society magazine, We're doing a lot of curricular stuff around gender to try to really police gender and what being female is for cisgender females. And so all of this is all kind of going on at the same time. And so there's all this debate going on amongst the general authorities. During this period, some believe that before the spirit birth, as spirit sons and daughters of heavenly parents, there was a prior generalist stage of existence where we existed as intelligences. In 1958, so think this is all going on at the same time, 1958, in doctrine, Mormon doctrine, Bruce R. McConkie asserts that intelligence is the state after spiritual birth, not before. And in 1967, BYU religion professor, I forgot to include his name, publishes a book describing two stages of premortal existence, namely the transition from intelligence to spirit. Nowhere in the scripture or in any authoritative source The central primal life of man said to be an intelligence, the existence of a living entity in the form and structure of man. That is, intelligences were pre-anthropomorphic and pre-gender. In 1972, Roger Turner, a different BYU professor, asserts gender is not an eternal characteristic, nor was an assignment of gender arbitrarily done by God. The principle of agency must have played a part in anything God did. The arbitrary assignment of sex would have left him particularly vulnerable to criticism. Thus, the act of choosing our sex was a distinct act of personal autonomy in the pre-existence in this view. In 1965, General Coffins, the assistant to the Corps of the 12, William Critch, gives a talk espousing similar views to what Turner does in his book in 1972. For Critchfield, various spiritual roles, and these are gendered roles and traits, influence one's choice of gender, thus becoming a conscious choice. One critic of Turner's books notes, if sex was voluntarily acquired in premortal life, then it should not completely shape mortal existence. Women should be people first. What a novel concept. So there's all this debate going on in the 60s and 70s of kind of when gender begins, when it doesn't. And then there's also, I didn't include on these slides, the debate as to whether gender will also perpetuate because of the genderlessness potentially of the TKs. Or as some referred the TK's movies, if the celestial kingdom is the highest level and we're only going to be able to procreate in that, there is the certain general authorities at the time that were thinking that basically gender and sex were pointless in the lower kingdoms, and thus would be genderless, and thus gender is not eternal. In 1983, however, these views had maintained some traction with the Corners 12 and general authorities until 1983, when then Apostle Gormley Hinckley asserts, "I know of no doctrine which states we made a choice when we came to earth as to whether we wish to be male or female. That choice was made by our Father in heaven in his infinite wisdom." So taking all the theoretical stuff that's going on at the time, and let's go into some practical stuff. So if you look at Greg Prince's book, Gay Rights in the Mormon Church, he does a chapter on trans history. In 1977, a trans woman is baptized in the ward where Greg Prince is the elder school president. The recommend included the prior name and the current name and noted that she was transsexual. In 1978, the state presidency, without specific reference to this trans woman, makes inquiry to a general authority, likely Hugh Pinnock, regarding endowment and temple marriage for trans women, for this trans woman. In June 1978, Hugh Pinnock writes in response, the answers you are about to receive are somewhat consensus in nature. He authorizes her endowment, going through with the name she was baptized under and uses at this time. He also pre-authorizes her temple marriage with the caveat that the woman has explained to a man the condition of her present physical body. Pinnock then underscores the fact that this should not be considered general policy, as some of the brethren, as we discussed, still feel that she has an eternal male spirit in a physically mutilated body. By February of 1980, February the following year, this trans woman is married in the DC temple by Hugh Pinnock and Greg Prince's attendants. By the following October is when the first presidency at General Conference issues the first policy barring trans surgery. Greg's book discusses the stages of evolution on church policy regarding birth control and draws parallels to the evolution in policy on transsexual inclusion versus exclusion. For Greg, he believes it will fall a small pot with birth control. There was no policy, and so it was basically Bishop Roulette. Then there was a draconian policy. And then we've evolved to basically it's up to the spouses or the individual to determine whether birth control is right for them. And he draws this as an analogy to how it may progress in the LDS Church on trans issues. And it kind of tracks that way. We had no policy, and we saw a trans woman married, endowed, but not then a draconian policy. And then it has gradually started to ease up. We now have one that is a policy that's pretty convoluted, but also seems to indicate that those that wrote the policy really don't get a lot of these pieces as far as transition-related care and things like that. So it kind of creates a lot of different catch-22s within the policy. But you can see how it is trying to progress in certain ways. And the policy before that had added the word elective before surgery. So it was, for me, that was a pretty particular word to insert elective surgery in the policy. Anyway, let's see. The church's policy has historically focused on the acts of surgery. So again, go from no policy, then as the frequency of concern grows, then the church issues the draconian policy. And as reality sets in, the policy evolves to a point the church abandons policy altogether and leaves it to the couple. Greg notes the trans policy at the time of publication added a reference to elective surgery and which softens the prior policy. So, again, these histories are all kind of going on at the same time and are kind of feeding off of each other. I have no specific evidence, but if you look at the timeline, you have a trans woman going through the temple and being married in the late 70s. And then Johns Hopkins issuing this study in 1979, closing its centers, and rather draconianly in October of 1980, within a year, they're issuing the first policy dead set against this. So I suspect at the time there may have been individuals within the general authorities that knew of the nuanced aspects of sex and how it played out. And so I think we see it play out in them issuing this policy in 1980 that was really informed by Johns Hopkins policy. That until that point they may have feared getting ahead of the science. But here's this policy from the leading medical school in the country and how much that may have come to bear on them issuing this recalling policy against surgery in 1980. That has then influenced policy within the church on trans people ever since. So that's my presentation. So open things up to Amy to navigate questions that come up and include concerns.
Thank you so much. My head is spinning and I've heard part of this before, but it's, you know how to just pack it all in and get right down to the most important everything. So thank you for that. And there are so many good questions here. So I'm just going to pick up from where you ended in terms of talking about, you know, the church seemed to want to rely on Johns Hopkins science as a way to justify some of their anti-trans stuff. And I'm wondering, thinking about that, one of the questions that came in was, in your opinion, how much of gender is society setting gender norms and then persons choosing to identify with their preferred set of norms, or is gender fully an internal decision? And I know there's, you know, there's science around this and the church has an opinion on this. It seems like, has that diverged more than it did in 1980?
I think it is. I think that there's a lot of divergence out there. And I think it's up to each individual to find their own answer in that space. For me, a lot of things are socially constructed. There is no gene that codes for women liking pink or girls liking pink. That is completely socially constructed, and at one point, actually, that was the masculine color. However, I grew up on a cattle ranch in Beaver, Utah, and yet have always, my internal sense of self was always female. And so there is some aspect within me that feels some aspect of innateness, whether that people consider that a spirit, and a gendered spirit, or some other aspect. Mm-hmm. That's for them to determine. But for me, there was that aspect. And yet I also realized that a lot of things are socially constructed, you know, and I'm 6'2", and I'm a bigger gal. And so some of the things I do as far as performativity in relation to gender are to get, there's that relational aspect, to be read as female. So makeup, long hair, wearing dresses. Doesn't mean I think women should only wear dresses. Those are all socially constructed cultural norms associated with being female. And so to be more consistently read and affirmed as, you know, those are things that I choose to do. I happen to like a lot of those things, but I don't think that there's some genetic component that's drawing me to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes me think about your, you know, your Judith Butler reference about how performance never ends, and then combined with the church's teaching recently in the Proclamation on the Family that gender is eternal. Like, does that idea exhaust you? that performance has to be maintained? Like, that, I mean, it exhausts me.
And I think it's also indicative of those that are issuing this from the church often conflate the terms gender and sex. So often, right. I think when they're saying gender is eternal, they're saying sex is eternal. And yet there's so much doctrinally that seems to contradict each other, because there is this question, you know, what are the other kingdoms like if we can only procreate in in the celestial kingdom, if we're only married and having spiritual sex, if you will, or whatever, in the social kingdom, is there a point to gender in the lower kingdoms, or is that how supposedly it's regulated in the lower kingdom, that we all become genderless?
Right.
Part of it is I've kind of come to a point where I'm okay with being me and here now, and we'll cross that bridge when we get to it.
Yeah. Well, and in that, since you brought up the celestial kingdom, I'm going to ask this question somebody asked. Within Mormon spaces, there's a lot of talk about wanting a female deity's presence. People are wanting to know more about Mother God. What impact do you see happening to our community if we further engender gods, offering gods capable of welcoming all forms? Further engender gods, offering gods capable of welcoming all forms. Yes.
Oh, somebody really knows me or just happened to touch a perfectly good nerve. I think this is where my heart still lays connected with the restoration in some regard. Mm-hmm. I think that the restoration through Joseph Smith had so much potential in this area. One of the things I loved when I converted to becoming Episcopal is, you know, there were two female priests to begin with that invited everyone to God's table to be nourished at God's meal. And in the Episcopal tradition, or at least in this parish, they see God as containing both the divine feminine and divine masculine. And that works to an extent for me. I'm not sure it fully works, but at least it provided space for that. And for me, what mother would deny a seat at the table for her child? And so here's the space where all are welcome to participate in Holy Eucharist. And tying that back to the restoration, how much within other forms of Christianity the divine feminine has been erased and suppressed. And there was just so much potential with restoration, with the acknowledgement of the Heavenly Mother, of Heavenly Parents. I worry that we lost that. That there's something there, and I'm not satisfied with what the church is saying, that, you know, it's protect Heavenly Mother and things like that. Mm-hmm. I don't think any mother would say cutting off contact is showing her respect. So,
yeah.
So I think there's a lot that I'm still sorting through around the divine feminine or Heavenly Mother. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot that all Judeo-Christian and other religions too are dealing with because of how patriarchy has suppressed and erased the feminine. I also honestly think that that's where a lot of sin is. Here is a lot of power that has been influenced to oppress and marginalize the divine feminine and females and women in service of certain people having more power. It feeds racism, feeds sexism, feeds homophobia.
Can you think of ways that, one of my concerns, because I want more divine mother in my life too, and divine feminine. I think we're drowning under patriarchy. But one of my concerns is always, you know, the more you emphasize the divine mother in Mormonism, the more heteronormative we seem to become. I wonder what ideas you have about how we bring in more of the divine mother and the, you know, that feminine divinity into our lives without reasserting eternal heteronormativity.
Well, particularly as a lesbian, queer, trans woman, it is very much a concern, and I don't have the answer to it. But you know, but I also think, you know, I was listening to one of the Year Polygamy podcasts from the other park on featuring Oh, we're getting our first name, Osler. Anyway, it's on queer polygamy. And I am no way endorsing polygamy, but it creates this possibility, right? That there are many different types of familial bonds, and Mormonism is a very queer religion, if you will. It queers the normative. And so there's actually, I think, a lot of potential ways that that could play out. Maddie Harrison, is that how you pronounce her name?
Yeah.
Wrote a phenomenal piece in the Exponent. Actually led me to subscribe to the Exponent on The Second Wife. It was absolutely beautiful and just really touched me about how the first wife was really there in the relationship because of our relationship with the second wife. So it was just, I'm not doing the story justice, but it was a beautiful story that really queered these narratives around how the afterlife could be constructed. And particularly if we try to address the problematic power dynamics that are constructed within Mormonism in the afterlife. It really seems like a very male-centric, procreative afterlife that seems kind of hellish. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, the way it's been described to me, endless childbirth doesn't sound very fun.
And yet it has so much potential for being re-envisioned in a much healthier way.
Yeah. Well, I love the way you brought up that there are so many different ways to envision like what eternal human relationships could look like outside of, yes, single man, single woman married that have been there since the very beginning. So I think that is a really important, an important thing to keep in mind when we talk about, yes, Heavenly Mother, not just immediately slot her into, yes, patriarchy's ideal of womanhood. There are so many good questions here. Let me just go through a few of these. I'm not going to try to tie them all together. One of the first questions was from your Audre Lorde quote about minorities should not bear the duty to educate majorities. The question is, who is best positioned to educate? What is the ideal?
So within this, it's actually putting the responsibility on those with power. You know, women didn't get the right to vote by giving themselves the right to vote. They had to fight for it and have men give them the right to vote. So to dismantle these systems of power, we actually need allies from the privileged power group to start to dismantle it. The education happens. There's putting the burden on the individual in the moment is not the right thing to do, the oppressed individual. But there is plenty of literature out there or other forms of media to actually become educated, to pull this part. You know, the stuff that I just presented, I didn't do just on my own. I read quite a bit. I engaged in discourse on Exponent 2. I watched documentary films. There's a phenomenal documentary film out right now. On trans narratives in media called Disclosure. It's on Netflix. I highly recommend it. Watch it. And this, I think, will help pull apart. So it's on us. You know, I'm a trans person, but my obligation, because of my white privilege, is to dismantle racism. So I might be marginalized, but I'll use the example. So I'm a psychotherapist. I'm a trans person, so I have certain aspects of marginalization, but I have a lot of privilege. I am white. I grew up in a fairly stable home with middle income. I got a college degree. I got a graduate degree from a Seven Sister, which is basically the Ivy League of women's colleges. Another graduate degree from another private institution. A professional license, a good income. And I'm sitting in a room doing an assessment and writing a letter as to whether a trans woman of color who had to drop out of school because she was kicked out of her home and has to engage in sex work to earn an income, whether she gets surgery or not. So am I really as marginalized as that person, a trans woman of color who's trying to get her surgery? And I've got a lot of power over what I need to be conscious of, and not just focus on how I'm only marginalized or oppressed. And yet, in other circumstances, when I'm engaged with somebody that has more power and privilege, it's incumbent on them to actually understand how their words and actions and behaviors are coming across as microaggressions to maintain systems of power and privilege and keep me as subordinate. So we see this a lot with post-Norman men who see themselves as progressive and yet are engaging in similar patterns of linguistic demarcation that still subordinate women and are not listening to how women are actually experiencing their words and actions and not uplifting women to have their voices heard.
Thank you for that. And it's something that you really do model well. I think, we hear a lot of people who are actually very privileged talk about all the time how they are being marginalized. And when I see you you come from a background that you could easily just say, I'm the most marginalized, and yet you always identify where you have power to lift other people up. And thank you for speaking to that so that other people won't let themselves off the hook quite so easily. I'm going to go through a few more of these questions. Can you envision a performance of gender that isn't governed or defined by patriarchal teachings, and what would that look like? So I think, in other words, you talked about how that Hopkins study was like, what proves whether or not a person can be transgendered is how successful they are at being fully feminine or fully masculine as defined by really patriarchal notions of femininity and masculinity. Can you imagine, as this question says, envision performance of gender that isn't governed or defined by those sort of patriarchal limits?
I think we're seeing it play out in the trans community right now, the diversity of gender experiences. Historically, this was very focused on a very binary understanding of sex and gender. So I identify within the binary as a trans woman. I like my femininity. I like expressing myself in that way. But as Amy can attest, I am in no means passive, submissive, some of those other words that come with supposedly female traits. And so I think there's ample opportunity to trouble these areas of gender and expression. And we see it play out even in cis individuals. Gender expression is, you have a lot of butch cis women out there versus very hyper-feminine women and everything in between. That being said, I think patriarchy, it's always a process. All these systems are, the work is never done. It's not being good or bad that I'm not racist or I'm not homophobic. It's about a process of becoming and learning, okay, let's dismantle this piece over time. But you've got all these different aspects of the trans community that are starting to really come out of, and individuals that are identifying as non-binary, and other different ways of identifying as far as gender. And so playing with different aspects of expression. But, in one of my feminist studies classes, they were talking, the professor admitted, we could dismantle gender and in theory end up with something very similar.
Yeah.
So it is, I think it is centering the individual and how they want to express themselves and how they want to be seen in relation to the world.
Well, following up on that, another question from somebody. Thank you, Stacey, for sharing your voice with us and for walking us along in education. What steps can each of us listening do to better validate and support our siblings in this journey? And I assume that they're referring to trans journey specifically.
I think asking the individual specifically, because each person is going to be unique as to what their needs are. Some it may be more emotional support, some may be more tangible support. Back in 2010, when I had general affirming surveillance, put it that way, my Episcopal Church community came together with my neighborhood community to do meals and walk the dog and things like that, so meeting tangible needs. Mm-hmm. And helping support my mom. My mom flew out, which mm-hmm. was a rather emotional experience for her at the same time. Mm-hmm. But she got to see how much community support was around me as well. And I also think it for her, there may have been some fear around how her being there for surgery may have been interpreted by the church and whether there may have been disciplinary actions. At least that was a worry on my part for her. Mm-hmm. So I think that there are different avenues to help support the individual and their family through this.
Okay. So a similar, in that same vein, another question. Do you suggest postponing meds and or surgery for trans-questioning persons until they are completely sure? In other words, should medical intervention occur sooner or later on the quote-unquote path to certainty?
So I think it depends, again, on the individual and also where they're at in life. There are different options available. So if I have a trans teen before me that's got a lot of support at home versus one that doesn't have a lot of support, the answers would be different. Mm-hmm. If I've got an adult that is later in life and hormones are going to have minimal effect, or a lot less effective than 20-something, it's going to be a different response. Mm-hmm. And part of this is centering the individual. A lot of the movement within trans care has been removing elements of gatekeeping. So particularly once you reach majority status, being an adult, a lot of medical providers have been moving towards an informed consent-based model for hormones, at least. So go in, sign the document, just like any other form of medical care, versus historically it required a letter from a therapist like me in order to get access to hormones. The biggest area right now is around teens needing transition-related services. And right now we have some really phenomenal options around puberty suppression to buy more time for the individual and their family if the family, it really isn't on board with consenting. Individuals generally know are fairly certain once they come to my office or a medical office that they're ready to transition. And there are different approaches even if there are some doubts. For instance, trans women might start on an androgen blocker, the feminizing hormone, at least to suppress the testosterone, things like that. So each course of treatment can be tailored to the unique needs of the individual. But the longer we wait, the more masculinizing or feminizing effects of the hormone, depending on how the person is transitioning. If I've got a trans teen who I thought identify as a trans woman and masculinizing, I mean, you witnessed this, but I went through facial feminization surgery last year, and it was brutal. And to clear the face of the beard area, it takes $200 to $400 of electrolysis, which is an electrical filament going into each follicle and electrocuting it to create an electrical and a chemical burn, and then having that extracted each hair for $200 to $400 to get it fully cleared. Or laser treatments, which clear about 80%, but aren't completely effective. So there's a lot of of pain and suffering that can be prevented by doing early intervention if we have some certainty. And part of this is gauging persistence. A lot of early interventions, nothing medically happens with a child until 10 or stage 2 of puberty. 10 or stage 2 is when you first see the first signs of puberty. And that's when we can either introduce hormone therapy or puberty suppression, depending on what things are at. If this is a person that transitioned at 6 years old, has persistently been identifying that way, no family, that child always have the choice to revert back. But now they're hitting 10 or stage 2, why am I going to put them on or advocate for them to be on suppression or drugs for another year, 2-3 years, when the gender identity is already known? Mm-hmm. So we can actually introduce hormone therapy so they continue their development with their peers. They develop fully like the gender identity of their peers rather than their natal sex. Mm-hmm. And basically acquires this privilege that comes with that.
Right. That's just knowing all of the clinical work you've done and then knowing your own story, because you've worked with lots of children and adults who have not had a Mormon background. I wonder how your, growing up with a Mormon background where you have this idea of an eternal identity in some form, how much that helped or hurt you in your transition?
I think it delayed it, even though I transitioned relatively long. I didn't come out to my family until I was 24, 25. I first came out to a friend here in D.C. when I lived here at age 18. So I graduated high school at 16 in Beaver, trying to escape a lot of harassment and bullying and whatnot. In junior high, I had been brutally beaten and had my head bashed against the platform in the locker room. And the only thing that saved me is the football coach pulling the assailant off of me. And so my mom knew I needed to get out of Beaver. So I graduated early at 16, went to my first year at Utah State, and was completely depressed. So I did a year long internship in D.C. And that's when I first came out to some friends, but didn't really move forward on any action. But when I moved back to Utah State, I connected with the counseling center at Utah State, and there happened to be a psychology intern there who identified as lesbian but was in a relationship with a transgender man. So that was when I was 19 years old. Had a big battle with my dad in the lobby of a hotel about not going on a mission. But anyway, got it into therapy there and had a letter for hormones and stuff like that, but this was in 2001, 2002. There were no resources to actually get on hormones at that time. Wow. Utah State now, you can get hormones right out of the student health center.
Wow.
And in working with the therapist, we came to the conclusion that for me to be successful in this, I needed to get my degree and likely needed to get at least stable at my job just in case I did lose my family. And so that's what I did. I plowed through a degree at Utah State once I returned in 18 months, graduated in the spring of 2003, came out to D.C. to work for Senator Kennedy. Luckily had a really good professor at Utah State that I'd taken several civil rights courses from, and many of you probably know Ross Peterson. He helped me get an internship and then on staff at with Senator Kennedy. But I also realized that I likely could not transition on the Hill. I was there when Senator Kennedy signed the non-discrimination proposal that included trans individuals, but I'd also been in a meeting where some of the mid-level managers were concerned about trans individuals being in the office. That's when I applied for work with an academic institution. And I felt like it was probably safer to transition. Mm. And worked to work at Alaska, D.C., same law school where Kit Kelly graduated from. Mm-hmm. So very feminist roots. And that's where, after a couple of years, some good reviews under my belt, I felt finally safe to come out and transition, and had good bosses that were on my side that helped go to bat to change the insurance policies to be inclusive. The first procedure I received was a black market procedure that was not good and resulted in hematomas and infection. That was because I had to pay out of the pocket and went to an illegal abortion clinic to get the procedure done. But that started things down the road to help further along insurance coverage in the U.S. for trans individuals. And by 2010, when I had full gender reassignment surgery, it was covered by our health insurance policy. So there's a lot of play there. But I think I held back so much around coming out and transitioning for fear of losing my family coming out. And to an extent, I did. My immediate family has been there for me. But my dad's side of the family has disavowed me. And that's the Mormon side. My mom converted when she was at Utah State. So I don't have much contact with my Mormon roots, if you will.
That's their loss. They don't know what they're missing out on. It makes me very sad for them. Just to sort of get back to that sort of first question and maybe the point to end on, in your presentation, you just briefly mentioned that you don't like the language that God made a mistake. And I wonder about how you feel like, the sense of your eternal self, and this is sense, and what you said about God not making a mistake, how that has helped you become the wonderful woman that you are.
I'm not sure. I don't know that I would describe myself as the wonderful woman that I am.
That's my words. I stand by.
I think that we're all born into different journeys through this life. None of us get out of it alive. And yet, I think, maybe the test isn't me. Maybe I am the test. So, I don't know. I think I don't like framing things from the negative, that God made a mistake. It's really a problematic frame for me. And there's a lot of different human conditions, for lack of a better phrase, that exist, and I don't think we should be seeing them as mistakes that God made. Mm-hmm. But why has this person been put in my path? And if we really are supposedly trying to become gods and goddesses, what might we be challenged with right here? Is this a learning opportunity for greater compassion, or that experience if we do become gods and goddesses? I think that there's just, trans is tough, but there's a lot of conditions that are much more difficult and painful.
As always, here you are advocating for everyone, everyone who needs it. So I think we are in our last 60 seconds, but so I would just like, I know, he told me it turns off in 90 minutes. So I just want to make sure I end by thanking you on behalf of all of the people who have listened to this and will listen to this for your generosity, and let them know that you are, yeah, come listen to Stacy spout truth in the Exponent Facebook group. This doesn't have to end.
I'm pretty direct.
That's right. Thank you so much, Stacy.
Thank you.